Angel, you don't need to know who I am, but you should know why I'm here. My grandpa, Stephen, is the author of a new exciting play called When the Break Happened in Orangeburg County. It's about our ancestors from when the break happened in 1865 until now. Many of my relatives are featured in the play, from my great-great-great-grandpa Stephen to my great-great-grandpa Stephen to my great-grandpa Stephen to my grandpa Stephen. Guess what my uncle and cousin's name are? Stephen. Go to www.thebreakinorangeburg.com to learn more. An online store has been created to honor those relatives and other families with products featuring the Break logo. Go to www.thebreakstore.com to purchase items today and help to produce this play. Please!
Welcome to a podcast show about stuff. It's the show about stuff, the Stephen Davis Show. Here's your host, Stephen Davis.
Hey, hey, welcome to the show about stuff, the Stephen Davis Show. This week, my guest is the fabulous Logan Westbrooks, one of the deans of the music industry, who has such wonderful stories. And as you can see in the back of him, there are some of the books that he's written that we're going to talk about later on in the show. Logan is widely recognized as one of the central figures responsible for opening the doors of the music industry to Black performers and executives. In addition to his pioneering role as the director of special markets at CBS in the 1970s, Westbrook is also known for his work as an educator. He's an international business consultant. He's an author. He's a real estate entrepreneur. He's a pastor, and he's a philanthropist. Welcome to our broadcast.
Thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure.
How do you get time to sleep with all those things that you do and have done?
Things have slowed down considerably. Then too, a lot of it is not by choice. Age, it's a father time we're creeping in, as well as sicknesses.
It does. And I, of course, wish everybody all the best as we all are growing older. Let's start off first with talking about your beginning. Where, when, and how?
Well, I really first started out in my beginning really was in Memphis, Tennessee, the heart of the South. And I can just so remember my early years of Black segregated schools, which was such an integral part of my foundation, those Blacks that compel you to do what you're supposed to do. And it paid off in the long run. It became an asset.
I understand, as you said, that it was segregated, but how was it as a boy growing up?
Being born in the South and being aware of the circumstances, you just adjusted to what was there, and you existed and moved forward. I can remember even the words of my high school principal. He always said, you've got to run faster, and you've got to jump higher. And there was no question. Exactly. I had to run faster, and I had to jump higher.
After you left Booker T. Washington High School, where did you?
I had Lamont Owen College in Memphis, Tennessee. So I took advantage of that, a two-year scholarship. Then I transferred to Lincoln University in Jefferson City, Missouri, with a major in business administration. After graduating from Lincoln, I was drafted into the Army for 24 months. Getting out of the Army, I moved to Chicago, Illinois. And fortunately, I had a brother that had attended the University of Chicago. So I moved to Chicago, Illinois. I first started working for Johnson Publishing Company as a merchandising salesman for about a year. I got a call from the Urban League, and they stated that R.C. Victor was in the process of hiring a management trainee. They suggested that I apply, and I did. And I got the job at the R.C. Victor Distributing Corp. as a management trainee. In a training program, you move around different areas of the company. And with RC Victor Distributed and Core, the main product line was what was called Home Entertainment Center. That are those big black and white television sets with the tape player, the record player, and all of that, as well pool washers and dryers. We also distributed RCA records. Moving around in the various areas of the company, I ended up in the record division, and that really was the beginning of it, and I just took off from there. And then after working in the record division for a short while, moving around in the streets of Chicago, I had heard that Capitol Records was looking to hire their first Black territory salesman. I applied for that job and I was hired. I did that for about a year and a half. And then I found out at Capitol that there was an opening for a regional promotion manager. And that regional position would be based in Chicago, but you'd be responsible for the entire Midwest. And my responsibility would entail securing airplane at all of the Black radio stations in those markets on all Capitol products. And I did that for about 2 years. In promotion, I was responsible for the Black Act, and that's who I dealt with there.
When you went to some of these places, because I would imagine that a lot of the venues or stores that you went to were white-owned. How did they treat you?
I didn't have any problem at all. As a salesman, I knew my product, and I had the product. If they had it, they didn't show it. I didn't have any difficulty at all, none whatsoever.
From Chicago, did you come to New York or did you go to California?
No, from Chicago, I went to LA. I was working at Capitol Records, and then I was promoted to the home office as the administrative assistant to the director of national promotion. So then I was transferred to Los Angeles, California, at Hollywood and Vine at the Capitol Tower in the home office for about a year. I heard that there was an opening at Mercury Records, but they wanted to hire a national promotion manager. I applied for that job, and I was hired. While there at Mercury Records in Chicago, I received a call from Columbia Records. So I flew into New York, and I sat down and met, and Clive told me about going very heavily into the Black music business, and would I be interested in becoming a part of that project? Absolutely. After I became convinced myself that they were serious about what they wanted to do, I in turn accepted that job on November of 1971. I left Mercury Records in Chicago and started working for CBS Records in New York City. It was my mission to create and establish a Black marketing division to dominate the Black music marketing business. And that's exactly what I did.
Take me through the steps as you're moving up in terms of your own feeling. And as you're moving up, you're meeting some of the major stars in this country from the music industry. How did you feel and how was your interaction with them?
Some of my fondest memories would be Cannonball Act. I enjoyed working with Nancy Wilson. I encountered Paul McCartney there at Capitol Records. That was a very interesting friendship. Earl Garner there at Mercury Records in Chicago. I had an opportunity to meet Mahalia Jackson because she was signed to CBS in New York. I remember even Herbie Hancock, that album when he was first sort of switching over, the album called Chameleon, and such a fine gentleman. So people like that. Joe Zawinul, Cannonball Adderley's brother, Nat Adderley. Just great, interesting people. They became lifelong friendship.
I remember meeting you and getting to ride around in your Rolls Royce. Oh, excuse me, yours and Jerry's. I was corrected about that by her before. So let me say, your and Jerry's Rolls Royce riding in Los Angeles. I'm trying to figure out, how do you feel as a human as you were going up higher and higher?
As you're going through in life, you really don't think about those things. As I reflect, you really don't think about those things. You just move along in life. You're trying to get ahead. You're trying to provide for your family. You're trying to live a good and fabulous life. And it certainly has been every bit of that. My wife and I, we've had a very, very good life. It also, because of the industry that I was in, it was a very fabulous life. So it was just enjoyable. And it also, on the financial side, very, very lucrative as well. We have been very, very blessed financially also.
That's Hey, fantastic. You could throw some my way. You were at the very beginnings of Soul Train. What involvement did you have in terms of Soul Train?
I was at the beginning of Soul Train Records. Soul Train, the TV show, came out of Chicago. And I was based in Chicago at the time. Don Cornelius and I, we were very, very good friends. As a matter of fact, it became a lifelong friendship from our association there in Chicago. But the show itself was when he moved to Los Angeles and he launched his show from Los Angeles. I, in turn, was working for CBS in New York City. And of course, it was always a situation whenever I came to Los Angeles, we spent a lot of time together. Whenever he came to New York City, we spent a lot of time together. And it was his thing that, man, I want to start this record and I want you to be a part of it. Now, I was working for CBS International at that particular time. So when he decided that he was ready to start Soul Train Records, that is when I resigned from CBS International. Now, I was based in Lagos, Nigeria, which really was a very, very fabulous job. So I resigned from CBS International. My wife and I, we moved back to Los Angeles, California, and started working with Soul Train Records. Now, it was Don's company, this guy named Dick Griffey, and was working there with and for Don. After a while, Don decided to close his label. Dick Griffey founded a company called Solar Records, which became very successful. I left, and I started dealing more like 100% in my real estate, you know, buying and investing in real estate property, which is very lucrative. And then a good friend of mine, who I had hired her as my administrative assistant at CBS. Now she's one of the head on the West Coast at a company called MCA New Venture. And they were looking for a Black to invest in a different venture. She suggested that I apply and turn in the proposal, which is what I did. And that proposal was a forming of Source Records. Now the initial financing came from MCA New Venture as a co-partner. Even though the money's loan was collateralized 100% by my wife and I. But that was the seed money for my label. I received a distribution deal with MCA Record Company, MCA Corp. So I was financed by MCA New Ventures, distributed, manufactured, and distributed by MCA Corp. That was the beginning of Source Records.
Let me step back a little bit. And the reason why I had mentioned about Soul Train was not so much about Soul Train Records, but it was like a convergence of you being in the position to have artists that could come on Soul Train and Soul Train needing talent to be able to do it. It seemed like it was just a great marriage, even before you all became partners.
Yeah, it was a great marriage in the sense that I was able to feed all of my acts into Don's show. And at that particular time, I had to be able to top act. It was OJ's. It was Johnny Nash. It was Johnny Mathis, Patti LaBelle.
That's what I'm getting at. That's why I knew that there was a nexus between Soul Train, the beginning of Soul Train's, maybe not so much the beginning, but what got Soul Train really going in terms of getting great acts and how you were involved.
It was a win-win situation for both of us. Don needed those top acts.
Yes.
And my acts needed that exposure. So it was a win-win situation.
Now, you get into real estate. It seems to me that real estate is a really rough and tumble business, but I guess it can't be too much more rough and tumble than the record business, can it?
I didn't look at it that way. Real estate, to me, I loved it. As a matter of fact, even before I became heavily involved in real estate, even when I was working for those people on a national basis, every city that I went into, I would always pick up the newspaper and go through the real estate sector, just interested in properties and things such as that. So I took advantage of that.
So where are some of the places that you've owned real estate at?
Some things in Memphis, Tennessee, but my main concentration was in Los Angeles, California. And that's really where I really, really stretched out in terms of multiple units, apartment buildings, office buildings, shopping centers. That was my area of specialty. And my fun really was in the negotiating. You negotiate and you close the deal, it was all over. But that was the fun part of it to me.
Now, you go in terms of the real estate, And then you move into another career, don't you? You have had a lot of careers and been very good at them.
Probably one you're probably referring to, that child care book. And that really came about because of the work that my wife was doing. She was a teacher at a facility in Malibu, California. And this was young boys, teenagers, that had been incarcerated. There was a regular school. And she was one of their teachers in that school. And they told her of the experiences they had in coming up as young. And they suggested to Mrs. Weston, why don't you open up a group home? Once we decided what she wanted to do, what we were going to do, I went out and purchased the old Jack Dempsey mansion, which is about a 9,000 square foot facility. We converted that into a boys' home for the boys ages of 6 to 12. We did that for 15 years.
Tell the audience, what famous thing happened at the school?
There was a movie called Gridiron Gang. And Gridiron Gang was based on the boys at the school where my wife was working. As the school teacher in that movie, that depiction was my wife. She played an integral part in working with those boys at that school.
And who was the actress that played your wife?
What was her name? A Puerto Rican actress out of New York. I can't think of her name. But she was a photo who's very, very successful even right now. Mm-hmm. But the male lead was Wayne Johnson. As a matter of fact, it was really the beginning. They really launched him into his really huge career. That picture has become classic.
Have some of the boys that you all dealt with, have they ever come back to you all and let you know how they're doing?
We hear from them all the time.
Here's your first surprise. Somebody that you've known from a long time ago, and he's going to make his appearance in a few seconds, and then somebody else has come on.
Killer.
What's happening?
I keep up here on Facebook.
Yeah, man. So you're looking good. So, you know, I'm just waiting. I was telling Steve, I'm just eager for this pandemic to subside somewhat because I need to get out to the West Coast. I plan to get out to California. So I figure that by the end of the year, things should be easing up a little bit.
Tell how you and Logan know each other.
Oh.
So our audience will know what the connection is and why you're on here. You just didn't pop up.
First of all, Logan and I went to the same high school in the Big M, Memphis, Tennessee. The other thing is that we went to the same university, Lincoln University in Jefferson City, Missouri. Logan was head of the student government there. Logan's always been a go-getter. He was always going to be on the top somewhere. Wherever he went, he was going to be on the top. He was head of student government, whatever, very dynamic there. And then when he was working at CBS, we were tied in here because he was in New York at the time. And when Logan was over in Africa, when Jerry wanted to go out someplace, Jerry, his wife, was still here. Logan would say, look, call Ulysses, call Killer. Tell him to take you out. Go with Killer. So I'd accompany her to different places. Johnny Mathis was in town. And so I went to see her, and Johnny Mathis was happy to see her. He called her by her name and everything. And then while Logan was in New York, and he was with Black Music, and he was tied in with Philadelphia International, invite us out to see Harold Melvin and Blue Notes and all the other folks. We had a great time together. There's another friend that we have too, Playtell Benjamin. We have another mutual friend here in New York, and I forgot to give his name to you, but Playtell is quite loquacious, and he probably the whole segment for the chat with Logan, but still, no, Playtell's a hell of a guy.
Let me bring my other guest in, Sheila. And what I want you all to do is tell me some interesting stories about Logan. So he can blush. But first, we're going to go to Sheila.
Hey, how you doing? Hey, I met you in Holland, remember?
I remember you very well. Yeah. Very well. And Mr. Logan. Logan is like a legend. He's just a legend. He's a maverick. Everybody knows, because I'm certain Ulysses probably said something about it, or you, Stephen, about his position in the music industry. He's one of the most well-respected men. Black men, but particularly in music. He did it all. Source Records, I remember Source Records, and coming up to the studio and hanging out with you and my girl, Jerry. But I tell you what I love most, and with all due respect to your music career, I was so impressed when you and Jerry had that home for a boy. That was phenomenal. You guys invited me there. and just to see how you had really adopted these 12 boys and were just guiding them through their lives. It was so impressive. I didn't know anybody who had ever done that like that. And I thought that I thought that nothing is worth more than that. Nothing. So I always had the deepest and the highest respect for you and Jerry, because it was just amazing. Jerry was a teacher. What was that place out in Malibu that Jerry was working?
Camp Kilpatrick.
Yes. And she invited me there and I was going to speak to the kids. So I'm like, oh, look how sweet they are. Jerry had this stone face. She wasn't playing. So she pulled me aside. She said, listen, some of these kids have killed people and blah, blah, blah. You can't come there the same way, okay? Watch me, okay? And they loved her. She was a no-nonsense person, and she taught me something. We've all been friends for a good while. Larkin and all of us, you, Larkin, and Cynthia, and just so many people. It was just great. You guys took me to dinner one of the times I was in LA.
Tell me a funny story. I want to hear a funny story.
I don't have a funny story. I don't think I have a funny story.
And I know Ulysses have one. They go way back, so he knows some funny stories.
Let's hear Ulysses then.
Logan's such a serious dude, man. Such a serious cat. Let me start off with another contribution that he made. And Logan was a real revolutionary. This is not a funny story, but this goes back to the music industry. We introduced the cassettes. That came from Logan. Yeah, the cassettes. Logan introduced that to the public. He took us from the LP to the cassette. I said, what's this little thing here, man? You know what I mean?
Wow.
Yeah, Logan was the one. He was a revolutionary.
You created the A-track? You introduced it into the industry.
Yes, yes.
Those A-track tapes were sold from service stations. And the reason being was the Learjet player. And service stations would sell and install the Learjet player. And as a result of that, we set up a little cardboard stand to display the 8-track tapes. So as you would have the hardware installed in your automobile at the service station, you also had a selection of 8-track tapes that you could buy right there on the spot. So that's where they were at the beginning. Of course, later on, they ended up in the record shop.
You know, that sounds like hip hoppers selling stuff out of the back of their cars.
When you said A-track, I know this is going back, but all I could think of was that scene out of Superfly when Carl tells like Ron, man, if you try to lead this, he says, we got this, we got an 8-track, whatnot. This is the American dream.
I was in management training program at RCA. They had that new device. The regular sales staff didn't want to bother with it. So they gave it to me. And that put me out in the streets moving around, service station and record shop. That's when I found out that Capitol Records was looking for a Black territory salesman. But that's the way that it came about.
You work your way up the ranks like that.
That's when I started finding out about other positions in the company. And then from there is when I went into a regional promotion manager. And that really was the beginning of it then.
Wow. At the Capitol. Right.
At Columbia for about 5 years.
About 5 years, okay. Were you and Larkin there at the same time?
After me.
Okay.
At the same time. Because when I was based on the West Coast at Capitol, Larkin started out at Capitol on the West Coast, and then out to the West Coast. So we worked together then in the Capitol Tower.
Okay, got it.
Now, when you were at CBS, how come they didn't just make you a vice president?
I have no idea. I'm convinced that I am that kind of a Black guy that white folks could only go so far with. And that's, as I reflect back, that it seems to be. As if they just didn't know which bag I was going to come out of. So they didn't feel secure.
Have you come up with that funny story?
Yeah. When we were back at Lincoln, there's this one instructor. His name was T. Charles McKinney. But he taught economics and he also taught statistics. And statistics was always a butt kicker. So we're having this exam and Logan was sitting across from me. Now Logan's the kind of guy, he'd read a whole book the night before. I mean, when it came to economics and banking and stuff like that, he'd read a whole book and memorize all this. He's got this photographic memory.
Wow.
I'd finished with my test. I had my little blue book and I had my test. All at once a hand came across the table and grabbed my test booklet. Logan grabbed my time, said, Logan, Mac is looking. That's what we call the instructor, T. Charles McKinney. But Logan was able to put down numbers that he felt comfortable with. and gave me my test booklet back. I was just thinking of that. And that was the only time when I saw Logan under pressure. Logan's always just the coolest guy in the room. He's always in control of things.
Logan, I know you wrote a number of books in terms of the music industry, which we discussed a little bit earlier. How do you see similarities, differences in the music industry between when you were in it and now?
As a business, those same basic things are there. You've got to have manufacturing. You've got to have marketing. You've got to have distribution. You've got to have advertising. So those basic things are still there. The R&B, pop, top 40, whatever it is, but those elements are always there in the mix. You can't get away from that. Hip hop is still the same element you've got to have.
How are the differences between the artists themselves? Or is there any difference?
The artists are now more in control of their career. They have more ownership of the things, which is the way that it should be. The way it's structured now, they have a bigger slice of the pie. It should be that way also, because they are the creative arm of it.
Now, how did you discover Chuck Brown when you were at Source Records?
I had just formed my label, and I was in the process of looking for acts, looking for material. I got this tape in the mail from Washington, D.C. I was teaching a class at Cal State LA at the time. I took that tape, and I had those youngsters in my college class to take a listen to it, and they fell in love with it immediately. I liked it also. So I hurriedly did the deal and made preparations to release it. And upon its release, it just mushroomed, took off. That was the beginning of it.
And how long did you have Source? What other artists did you have on Source?
I had Harold Melvin in the Blue Notes. I had Sly Stone sister called Rose Banks. I had a Violet and Travis Biggs. I had two brothers called the Valentine Brothers, who very, very popular in England even right now. I had a group called Smash.
My brothers were some bad dudes, man.
Now, after all of this, you changed careers in terms of how you expressed your faith. And I remember when I was staying at the Embassy Suite by the airport, you came and got me and took me to your church one Sunday morning. That maybe where Lionel Richie came in at one Sunday morning. Talk about that.
I grew up in the Church of God in Christ, which was founded by Bishop Mason. Those roots were always there. And then when I had, the second time I moved out here to the West Coast, I was attending Andre Crouch's father's church, Bishop Crouch. He really just pushed me over into the ministry. Eventually, I ended up pastoring the church.
A wonderful pastor, too. You were wonderful. I had the pleasure of visiting the church several times. I remember on Thanksgiving, you guys, I don't know how many turkeys that the church purchased and just gave to so many people in the community. It was very special.
Talk about the fact that you donated your archives to Indiana University.
Interesting the way that that came about. Portia and Mosby. And Portia was stirred to me by Regina Jones. When she came to my office, she saw all these posters and pamphlets and things all over, just everywhere, all over my office. And she asked the question, what are you going to do with all of this stuff? I said, I'm not going to do anything with it. She suggested, why don't you donate it to the University of Indiana so they can digitize it and archive it and be available for scholars all over the world? So we packed all that stuff up and we sent it to the University of Indiana, and that's exactly what they did. So now online, you can go to the Logan Westbrook's collection, Indiana University, and you see all kinds of record company stuff.
Are there personal papers that you also donated? Or was
all
it just
everything? Everything.
What are some of the interesting things that were in those archives that people would want to go to online to see?
I tell you an interesting thing right now. There was the first filmmaker from Nigeria. His name was Francis Oladele. And Francis Oladele was married to Maynard Jackson's sister. Huh. So I met her there in Nigeria when I was doing some business with CBS International with Francis Oladele. Just within the past 6 months, I received a call from the University of Indiana, the archives, and there was a request for a company out of Germany. They were in the process of putting on an exhibit in Nigeria on the first filmmaker from Nigeria, which is Francis Oladele. In my collection, I had about more than a dozen pictures of Francis Oladele and I and other business people, along with fella in my collection. They went to that collection and they observed all of that. They would like to display that along with their display on Francis Oladele in Nigeria. They contacted University of Indiana. They in turn contacted me for possession of it. Also, I found out then that Ossie Davis was the first executive producer of that very first film that Francis Oladele, it was called Congo's Harvest. And so that's one of the things, the advantages of being online on a worldwide basis.
How are the sales going with your book? Is it still going?
Going very well, going very well.
How can people get it?
Amazon, get it on Amazon.
I know that we had a wonderful time, Ulysses and I and Sheila, sponsoring a book signing for you here in New York at my place. And I always appreciated that. You have something else?
I just wanted to mention that when Logan came back from Nigeria, he was telling me how he was in this meeting and telling the Nigerian brothers, look, man, you should see at least 51% control. It's you and your country. You should have the controlling interest. And he was so disappointed in that the Nigerian gentlemen who were there wound up accepting something less than about 39% of the less interest and put the controlling interest in the hands of these foreigners. Logan told me, said, man, look, I love my Nigerian brothers, but when it comes to business, I just have some second thoughts about that. He said that I would suggest that if you're planning on doing in the business, just be aware of the fact that things don't necessarily come out the way that you'd expect them to come out. And you try to rationalize the situation as to why they wouldn't have saw it being in their interest to have 51% or controlling interest, at least 51%. He said he still was struggling with trying to understand why they accepted something less than that. And I won't forget that. I won't forget it. And I personally have had some dealings with some of my African brothers, and some of them were really astute, man. But at the same time, we still sometimes think that the man's ice water is colder than ours. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the effect, colonialism, oppression, racism. I think that we are coming out of that now. I think we're gradually coming out of it, whereby we're becoming more assertive and demanding our own and seeking to control the economics of what we're doing. As a matter of fact, when you were asking Logan about the music industry today, and Logan was talking about how the musicians now are seeking to control their product, there's just a greater awareness now as to an importance of controlling right. The economics of your product. And I would like to think that the Nigerian brothers have become more enlightened as to the importance of that also.
I was actually, when Ulysses was saying that, I was thinking about in the church world, the Nigerians own some of the largest number of churches throughout Africa and in different parts of the world. There's a Pastor Chris, he's got something like 4,000, they call them cells, and they're very economically savvy. When I was in Nigeria, the one thing that I recognized was the number of disadvantaged, you know, people. Only 3% of the population were economically wealthy, and the rest were poor. I think you have the shrewd Africans, and I'm thinking about Nigeria, but it changes in different parts of Africa. You were right when you said so many of them have been under colonialism, like in South Africa. So it depends on where you are. I've always found the Nigerians to be pretty shrewd business people. I don't know. Logan, what do you think?
There is one Nigerian businessman that I haven't been in touch with for quite some time, but I really was impressed. His name was Harry Akande.
That was my dear friend.
Well, I first met Henry when I was working on that project for CBS International. Very astute businessman. I think he
very much so. Him. Yes. Yes. You know what? He and his family invited me to like Cannes one year. I spent time with them at the Cannes Film Festival.
Sheila.
Hello.
Where's Jerry?
How you feeling, Jerry?
I'm coming to California next Friday. Time to go break bread.
You're looking good. That's a bad hat you got on there, Jerry. Yeah, that's mean.
your life and your philosophy, Logan, over the years. That the theme of this podcast every week is prosperity despite obstacles. And well, certainly your life falls into that category.
I certainly would suggest that whatever stumbling blocks that are there, move around them or jump over them and just keep on moving. And also it's very important to, after you have achieved, to share what you have and to share your experiences on those that come behind you, which really was one of the main reasons for writing those books. I was trying to share my experiences so those coming behind me can use that as a guide or as a blueprint. Very important. I would like to mention the museum there in Nashville, Tennessee. I have a lot of stuff that's there as well. As a matter of fact, some of the stuff is borrowed from the University of Indiana that's there in Nashville at the back museum there. So that's a must for all of you.
Oh, tell us about the museum.
It's an African American Music Museum. It is well funded. And it's right downtown in Nashville, right in the heart of everything. It's a major entity. So check it out when you get a chance.
Wow.
I just want to take a moment to just suggest something to Logan. I know that you're involved in the ministry, and there's a book that was written by this African, Nana Dakwa Bancha, and it's Africans Who Wrote the Bible. Have you come across that book?
No, I haven't.
You can Google it. Just Google it. Africans Who Wrote the Bible. It's just fascinating. Just fascinating. Like we use a DNA sequence, he used name sequence. Okay. And all those names in the Bible, he traced them back to Africa. It's riveting.
We are at the end, and I do want to thank Logan Westbrooks for all that he's done, because he was a pioneer in the music industry for Black folks and where they're at right now. There are a couple other folks that are out there also, but certainly Logan is in the middle of those that have helped Black artists that are making all this money today.
Yeah, revolutionary.
So I do thank you all and look forward to our next show next week. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for tuning in this week. Hope you enjoyed this show about stuff. See you next time.
The Break Store. Unique branded gifts for the holidays, birthdays, or just because. Visit us at www.thebreakstore.com. Hit the right black get in touch button.